Audio Renaissance presents Knife of Dreams, Book 11 of The Wheel of Time, by Robert Jordan. Read for you by Kate Redding and Michael Kramer.
The sweetness of victory and the bitterness of defeat are like a knife of dreams. From Fog and Steel by Madoc Comadren. Prologue. Embers falling on dry grass. The sun, climbing toward mid-morning, stretched Galad's shadow and those of his three armored companions ahead of them as they trotted their mounts down the road that ran straight through the forest, dense with oak and leatherleaf, pine and sour gum, most showing the red of spring growth. He tried to keep his mind empty, still, but small things kept intruding. The day was silent save for the thud of their horses' hooves. No bird sang on a branch, no squirrel chittered. Too quiet for the time of year, as though the forest held its breath. This had been a major trade route once, long before Amadicia and Terabon came into being, and bits of ancient paving stone sometimes studded the hard-packed surface of yellowish clay. A single farm cart far ahead behind a plodding ox was the only sign of human life now besides themselves. Trade had shifted far north, farms and villages in the region dwindled, and the fabled lost mines of Aelgar remained lost in the tangled mountain ranges that began only a few miles to the south. Dark clouds massing in that direction promised rain by afternoon if their slow advance continued. A red-winged hawk quartered back and forth along the border of the trees, hunting the fringes, as he himself was hunting, but at the heart, not on the fringes. The manor house that the Seanchan had given Eamon Valda came into view, and he drew rein, wishing he had a helmet strap to tighten for excuse. Instead, he had to be content with rebuckling his sword belt, pretending that it had been sitting wrong. There had been no point to wearing armor. If the morning went as he hoped, he would have had to remove breastplate and mail in any case, and if it went badly, armor would have provided little more protection than his white coat. Formerly a deep country lodge of the King of Amadicia, the building was a huge blue-roofed structure studded with red-painted balconies, a wooden palace with wooden spires at the corners atop a stone foundation like a low, steep-sided hill. The outbuildings, stables and barns, workmen's small houses and craftsfolk's workshops all hugged the ground in the wide clearing that surrounded the main house, but they were nearly as resplendent in their blue and red paint. A handful of men and women moved around them, tiny figures yet at this distance, and children were playing under their elders' eyes, an image of normality where nothing was normal. His companions sat their saddles in their burnished helmets and breastplates, watching him without expression. Their mounts stamped impatiently, the animals' morning freshness not yet worn off by the short ride from the camp. "It's understandable if you're having second thoughts, Dumadred," Trom said after a time. "It's a harsh accusation, bitter as gall, but..." "No second thoughts for me," Galad broke in. His intentions had been fixed since yesterday. He was grateful, though. Trom had given him the opening he needed. They had simply appeared as he rode out, falling in with him without a word spoken. There had seemed no place for words then. "But what about you three? You're taking a risk coming here with me. A risk you have no need to take. However the day runs, there will be marks against you. This is my business, and I give you leave to go about yours." Too stiffly said, but he could not find words this morning or loosen his throat. The stocky man shook his head. "The law is the law, and I might as well make use of my new rank." The three golden star-shaped knots of a captain sat beneath the flaring sunburst on the breast of his white cloak. There had been more than a few dead at Jeramel, including no fewer than three of the Lord's captain. They had been fighting the Seanchan then, not allied with them.
"I've done dark things in service to the light," Gaunt-faced Biar said grimly, his deep-set eyes glittering as though at a personal insult. "Dark as moonless midnight. And likely I will again. But some things are too dark to be allowed."
He looked as if he might spit.
"That's right,"
young Bornhald muttered, scrubbing a gauntleted hand across his mouth. Galad always thought of him as young, though the man lacked only a few years on him. Dane's eyes were bloodshot. He had been at the brandy again last night.
If you've done what's wrong, even in service to the light, then you have to do what's right to balance it.
Biar grunted sourly. Likely that was not the point he had been making.
Very well, Galad said, but there's no fault to any man who turns back. My business here is mine alone.
Still, when he heeled his bay gelding to a canter, he was pleased to have them gallop to catch him and fall in alongside, white cloaks billowing behind. He would have gone on alone, of course, yet their presence might keep him from being arrested and hanged out of hand. Not that he expected to survive in any case. What had to be done, no matter the price. The horse's hooves clattered loudly on the stone ramp that climbed to the manor house, so every man in the broad central courtyard turned to watch as they rode in. 50 of the children, in gleaming plate and mail and conical helmets, most mounted, with cringing, dark-coated Amadisian grooms holding animals for the rest. The inner balconies were empty except for a few servants who appeared to be watching while pretending to sweep. 6 questioners, big men with the scarlet shepherd's crook upright behind the sun flare on their cloaks, stood close around Radam Asunawa like a bodyguard, away from the others. The Hand of the Light always stood apart from the rest of the children, a choice the rest of the children approved. Gray-haired Asunawa, his sorrowful face making Biar look fully fleshed, was the only child present not in armor, and his snowy cloak carried just the brilliant red crook, another way of standing apart. But aside from marking who was present, Galad had eyes for only one man in the courtyard. Asunawa might have been involved in some way, that remained unclear. Yet only the Lord Captain Commander could call the High Inquisitor to account. Eamon Valda was not a large man, but his dark, hard face had the look of one who expected obedience as his due. As the very least, he was due. Standing with his booted feet apart and his head high, command in every inch of him, he wore the white and gold tabard of the Lord Captain Commander over his gilded breast and back plates, a silk tabard more richly embroidered than any Pedran Nile had worn. His white cloak, the flaring sun large in either breast and thread of gold, was silk as well, and his gold-embroidered white coat. The helmet beneath his arm was gilded and worked with the flaring sun on the brow, and a heavy gold ring on his left hand, worn outside his steel-backed gauntlet, held a large yellow sapphire, carved with the sunburst. Another mark of favor received from the Shan-Chan. Valda frowned slightly as Galad and his companions dismounted and offered their salutes arm across the chest. Obsequious grooms came running to take their reins.
"Why aren't you on your way to Nassad, Trom?"
Disapproval colored Valda's words.
"The other Lord's captain will be halfway there by now."
He himself always arrived late when meeting the Shan-Chan, perhaps to assert that some shred of independence remained to the children. Finding him already preparing to depart was a surprise. This meeting must be very important. But he always made sure the other high-ranking officers arrived on time, even when that required setting out before dawn. Apparently, it was best not to press their new masters too far. Distrust of the children was always strong in the Shan-Chan. Trom displayed none of the uncertainty that might have been expected from a man who had held his present rank barely a month.
"An urgent matter, my Lord Captain Commander,"
he said smoothly, making a very precise bow, neither a hair deeper nor higher than protocol demanded.
"A child of my command charges another of the children with abusing a female relative of his, and claims the right of trial beneath the light, which by law you must grant or deny." "A strange request, my son," Asunawa said, tilting his head quizzically above clasped hands before Valda could speak.
Even the High Inquisitor's voice was doleful. He sounded pained at Trom's ignorance. His eyes seemed dark-hot coals in a brazier.
"It was usually the accused who asked to give the judgment to swords, and I believe usually when he knew the evidence would convict him. In any case, trial beneath the light has not been invoked for nearly 400 years. Give me the accused's name, and I will deal with the matter quietly."
His tone turned chill as a sunless cavern in winter, though his eyes still burned.
"We are among strangers, and we cannot allow them to know that one of the children is capable of such a thing."
"The request was directed to me, Asinawa,"
Valda snapped. His glare might as well have been open hatred. Perhaps it was just dislike of the other man's breaking in. Flipping one side of his cloak over his shoulder to bear his ring-quilled sword, he rested his hand on the long hilt and drew himself up. Always one for the grand gesture, Valda raised his voice so that even people inside probably heard him, and declaimed rather than merely spoke.
"I believe many of our old ways should be revived, and that law still stands. It will always stand, as written of old. The light grants justice because the light is justice. Inform your man he may issue his challenge, Trom, and face the one he accuses sword to sword. If that one tries to refuse, I declare that he has acknowledged his guilt and order him hanged on the spot, his belongings and rank forfeit to his accuser, as the law states. I have spoken."
That with another scowl for the High Inquisitor. Maybe there really was hatred there. Trom bowed formally once more.
"You have informed him yourself, my Lord Captain Commander. Damodred?"
Galad felt cold. Not the cold of fear, but of emptiness. When Dane drunkenly let slip the confused rumors that had come to his ears, when Bayar reluctantly confirmed they were more than rumors, rage had filled Galad, a bone-burning fire that nearly drove him insane. He had been sure his head would explode if his heart did not burst first. Now he was ice, drained of any emotion. He also bowed formally. Much of what he had to say was set in the law, yet he chose the rest with care, to spare as much shame as possible to a memory he held dear.
"Eamon Valda, child of the light, I call you to trial beneath the light for unlawful assault on the person of Morghaes Trakand, Queen of Andor, and for her murder."
No one had been able to confirm that the woman he regarded as his mother was dead, yet it must be so. A dozen men were certain she had vanished from the Fortress of the Light before it fell to the Seanchan, and as many testified she had not been free to leave of her own will. Valda displayed no shock at the charge. His smile might have been intended to show regret over Galad's folly in making such a claim, yet contempt was mingled in it. He opened his mouth, but Asinawa cut in once more.
"This is ridiculous,"
he said in tones more of sorrow than of anger.
"Take the fool and we'll find out what dark friend plot to discredit the children he is part of."
He motioned, and two of the hulking questioners took a step toward Galad, one with a cruel grin, the other blank-faced, a workman about his work. Only one step, though. A soft rasp repeated around the courtyard as children eased their swords in their scabbards. At least a dozen men drew entirely, letting their blades hang by their sides. The Amadisian grooms hunched in on themselves, trying to become invisible. Likely they would have run had they dared. Asinawa stared around him, thick eyebrows climbing up his forehead in disbelief, knotted fists gripping his cloak. Strangely, even Valda appeared startled for an instant. Surely he had not expected the children to allow an arrest after his own proclamation. If he had, he recovered quickly.
"You see, Asinawa," he said almost cheerfully, "the children follow my orders and the law, not a questioner's whims."
He held out his helmet to one side for someone to take.
"I deny your preposterous charge, young Galad, and throw your foul lie in your teeth. For it is a lie, or at best a mad acceptance of some malignant rumor started by dark friends or others who wish the children ill. Either way, you have defamed me in the vilest manner, so I accept your challenge to trial beneath the light, where I will kill you."
That barely squeezed into the ritual, but he had denied the charge and accepted the challenge. It would suffice. Realizing that he still held the helmet in an outstretched hand, Valda frowned at one of the dismounted children, a lean Saldaean named Kashgar, until the man stepped forward to relieve him of it. Kashgar was only an under-lieutenant, almost boyish despite a great hooked nose and thick mustaches like inverted horns, yet he moved with open reluctance, and Valda's voice was darker and acrid as he went on, unbuckling his sword belt and handing that over too.
"Take a care with that, Kashgar. It's a Heronmark blade."
Unpinning his silk cloak, he let it fall to the paving stones, followed by his tabard, and his hands moved to the buckles of his armor. It seemed that he was unwilling to see if others would be reluctant to help him. His face was calm enough, except that angry eyes promised retribution to more than Galad.
"Your sister wants to become Aes Sedai, I understand, Damodred. Perhaps I understand precisely where this originated. There was a time I would have regretted your death, but not today. I may send your head to the White Tower so the witches can see the fruit of their scheme."
Worry creasing his face, Dane took Galad's cloak and sword belt, and stood shifting his feet as though uncertain he was doing the right thing. Well, he had been given his chance, and it was too late to change his mind now. Bayar put a gauntleted hand on Galad's shoulder and leaned close.
"He likes to strike at the arms and legs," he said in a low voice, casting glances over his shoulder at Valda.
From the way he glared, some matter stood between them. Of course, that scowl differed little from his normal expression.
"He likes to bleed an opponent until the man can't take a step or raise his sword before he moves for the kill. He's quicker than a viper, too, but he'll strike at your left most often and expect it from you."
Galad nodded. Many right-handed men found it easier to strike so, but it seemed an odd weakness in a blade master. Gareth Bryn and Henry Haslin had made him practice alternating which hand was uppermost on the hilt so he would not fall into that. Strange that Valda wanted to prolong a fight, too. He himself had been taught to end matters as quickly and cleanly as possible.
"My thanks," he said, and the hollow-cheeked man made a dour grimace.
Bayar was far from likable, and he himself seemed to like no one save young Bornhold. Of the three, his presence was the biggest surprise, but he was there, and that counted in his favor. Standing in the middle of the courtyard, in his gold-worked white coat, with his fists on his hips, Valda turned in a tight circle.
"Everyone move back against the walls," he commanded loudly.
Horseshoes rang on the paving stones as the children and the grooms obeyed. Asunawa and his questioners snatched their animals' reins, the High Inquisitor wearing a face of cold fury.
"Keep the middle clear. Young Damodred and I will meet here."
"Forgive me, my lord Captain Commander," Trom said with a slight bow.
"But since you are a participant in the trial, you cannot be arbiter. Aside from the High Inquisitor, who by law may not take part, I hold the highest rank here after you. So, with your permission..."
Valda glared at him, then stalked over to stand beside Kashgar, arms folded across his chest. Ostentatiously, he tapped his foot, impatient for matters to proceed. Galad sighed. If the day went against him, as seemed all but certain, his friend would have the most powerful man in the children as his enemy. Likely Trom would have had in any event, but more so now.
"Keep an eye on them,"
he told Bornhold, nodding toward the questioners, clustered on their horses near the gate. Asunawa's underlings still ringed him like bodyguards, every man with a hand on his sword hilt.
"Why? Even Asunawa can't interfere now. That would be against the law."
It was very hard not to sigh again. Young Dane had been a child far longer than he, and his father had served his entire life, but the man seemed to know less of the children than he himself had learned. To questioners, the law was what they said it was.
"Just watch them."
Trom stood in the center of the courtyard with his bared sword raised overhead, blade parallel to the ground, and unlike Valda, he spoke the words exactly as they were written.
"Under the light, we are gathered to witness trial beneath the light, a sacred rite of any child of the light. The light shines on truth, and here the light shall illuminate justice. Let no man speak save he who has legal right, and let any who seek to intervene be cut down summarily." Here justice will be found under the light by a man who pledges his life beneath the light, by the force of his arm and the will of the light. The combatants will meet unarmed where I now stand," he continued, lowering the sword to his side, "and speak privately for their own ears alone. May the light help them find words to end this short of bloodshed, for if they do not, one of the children must die this day, his name stricken from our rolls, and anathema declared on his memory. Under the light it will be so."
As Trom strode to the side of the courtyard, Valda moved toward the center in the walking stance called Cat Crosses the Courtyard, an arrogant saunter. He knew there were no words to stop blood being shed. To him, the fight had already begun. Galad merely walked out to meet him. He was nearly a head taller than Valda, but the other man held himself as though he were the larger and confident of victory. His smile was all contempt this time.
"Nothing to say, boy? Small wonder, considering that a blade master is going to cut your head off in about 1 minute. I want one thing straight in your mind before I kill you, though. The wench was hale the last time I saw her, and if she's dead now, I'll regret it."
That smile deepened both in humor and disdain.
"She was the best ride I ever had, and I hope to ride her again one day."
Red-hot searing fury fountained inside Galad, but with an effort, he managed to turn his back on Valda and walk away, already feeding his rage into an imagined flame, as his two teachers had taught him. A man who fought in a rage died in a rage. Floating in emptiness, he drew his sword from the scabbard Bornhold proffered, and the slightly curved blade became a part of him.
"What did he say?" Dane asked. "For a moment there, your face was murderous."
Bjar gripped Dane's arm.
"Don't distract him," he muttered.
Galad was not distracted. Every creak of saddle leather was clear and distinct, every ringing stamp of hoof on paving stone. He could hear flies buzzing 10 feet away as though they were at his ear. He almost thought he could see the movements of their wings. He was one with the flies, with the courtyard, with the two men. They were all part of him, and he could not be distracted by himself. Valda waited until he turned before drawing his own weapon on the other side of the courtyard. A flashy move, the sword blurring as it spun in his left hand, leaping to his right to make another blurred wheel in the air before settling upright and rock-steady before him in both hands. He started forward once more and Cat Crosses the Courtyard. Raising his own sword, Galad moved to meet him, without thought, assuming a walking stance, perhaps influenced by his state of mind. Emptiness, it was called, and only a trained eye would know that he was not simply walking. Only a trained eye would see that he was in perfect balance every heartbeat. Valda had not gained that Heron Mark sword by favoritism. 5 blade masters had sat in judgment of his skills and voted unanimously to grant him the title. The vote always had to be unanimous. The only other way was to kill the bearer of a Heron Mark blade in fair combat, one-on-one. Valda had been younger than Galad was now. It did not matter. He was not focused on Valda's death. He was focused on nothing. But he intended Valda's death if he had to sheathe the sword, willingly welcoming that Heron Mark blade in his flesh to achieve it. He accepted that it might come to that. Valda wasted no time with maneuvering. The instant he was within range, plucking the low-hanging apple flashed toward Galad's neck like lightning, as though the man truly did intend to have his head in the first minute. There were several possible responses, all made instinct by hard training, but Bjar's warnings floated in the dim recesses of his mind, and also the fact that Valda had warned him of this very thing. Warned him twice. Without conscious thought, he chose another way, stepping sideways and forward just as plucking the low-hanging apple became the leopard's caress. Valda's eyes widened in surprise as his stroke missed Galad's left thigh by inches. Widened more as parting the silk laid a gash down his right forearm. But he immediately launched into the dove takes flight, so fast that Galad had to dance back before his blade could bite deeply, barely fending off the attack with Kingfisher Circles the Pond. Back and forth they danced the forms, gliding this way, then that, across the stone paving. Lizard in the thornbush met lightning of three prongs. Leaf on the breeze countered eel among the lily pads, and two hares leaping met the hummingbird kisses the honey rose. Back and forth as smoothly as a demonstration of the forms. Galad tried attack after attack, but Valda was as fast as a viper. The woodgrass dances cost him a shallow gash on his left shoulder, and the red hawk takes a dove, another on the left arm, slightly deeper. River of Light might have taken the arm completely had he not met the draw cut, with a desperately quick rein in the high wind. Back and forth, blades flashing continuously, filling the air with the clash of steel on steel. How long they fought he could not have said. There was no time, only the moment. It seemed that he and Valda moved like men under water, their motions slowed by the drag of the sea. Sweat appeared on Valda's face, but he smiled with self-assurance, seemingly untroubled by the slash on his forearm, still the only injury he had taken. Galad could feel the sweat rolling down his own face, too, stinging his eyes, and the blood trickling down his arm. Those wounds would slow him eventually, perhaps already had, but he had taken two on his left thigh, and both were more serious. His foot was wet in his boot from those, and he could not avoid a slight limp that would grow worse with time. If Valda was to die, it must be soon. Deliberately, he drew a deep breath, then another, through his mouth. Another. Let Valda think he was becoming winded. His blade lanced out in threading the needle, aimed at Valda's left shoulder, and not quite as fast as it could have been. The other man countered easily with the swallow takes flight, sliding immediately into the lion springs. That took a third bite in his thigh. He dared not be faster in defense than in attack. Again he launched, threading the needle at Valda's shoulder, and again, again, all the while, gulping air through his mouth. Only luck kept him from taking more wounds in those exchanges. Or perhaps the light really did shine on this fight. Valda's smile widened. The man believed him on the edge of his strength, exhausted and fixated. As Galad began threading the needle too slowly for the fifth time, the other man's sword started the swallow takes flight in an almost perfunctory manner. Summoning all the quickness that remained to him, Galad altered his stroke, and reaping the barley sliced across Valda just beneath his ribcage. For a moment it seemed that the man was unaware he had been hit. He took a step, began what might have been stones falling from the cliff. Then his eyes widened and he staggered, the sword falling from his grip to clatter on the paving stones as he sank to his knees. His hands went to the huge gash across his body as though trying to hold his insides within him, and his mouth opened, glassy eyes fixed in Galad's face. Whatever he intended to say, it was blood that poured out over his chin. He toppled onto his face and lay still. Automatically, Galad gave his blade a rapid twist to shake off the blood staining its last inch, then bent slowly to wipe the last drops onto Valda's white coat. The pain he had ignored now flared. His left shoulder and arm burned. His thigh seemed to be on fire. Straightening took effort. Perhaps he was nearer exhaustion than he had thought. How long had they fought? He had thought he would feel satisfaction that his mother had been avenged, but all he felt was emptiness. Valda's death was not enough. Nothing except Morgaestra Kand alive again could be enough. Suddenly he became aware of a rhythmic clapping, and looked up to see the children, each man slapping his own armored shoulder in approval. Every man. Except Asunawa and the questioners. They were nowhere to be seen. Bayar hurried up, carrying a small leather sack, and carefully parted the slashes in Galad's coat sleeve.
"Those will need sewing," he muttered, "but they can wait."
Kneeling beside Galad, he took rolled bandages from the sack and began winding them around the gashes in his thigh.
"These need sewing, too, but this will keep you from bleeding to death before you can get it."
Others began gathering around, offering congratulations, men afoot in front, those still mounted behind. None gave the corpse a glance except Kashgar, who cleaned Valda's sword on that already blood-stained coat before sheathing it.
"Where did Asunawa go?" Galad asked.
"He left as soon as you cut Valda the last time," Dane replied uneasily. "He'll be heading for the camp to bring back questioners."
"He rode the other way, toward the border," someone put in.
Nasad lay just over the border.
"The Lord's captain," Galad said, and Trom nodded.
"No child will let the questioners arrest you for what happened here, Damodred. Unless his captain ordered it. Some of them would order it, I think."
Angry muttering began, men denying they would stand for such a thing, but Trom quieted them somewhat with raised hands.
"You know it's true," he said loudly. "Anything else would be mutiny."
That brought dead silence. There had never been a mutiny in the children. It was possible that nothing before had come as close as their own earlier display.
"I'll write out your release from the children, Galad. Someone may still order your arrest, but they'll have to find you, and you'll have a good start. It will take half the day for Asunawa to catch the other lord's captain, and whoever falls in with him can't be back before nightfall."
Galad shook his head angrily. Trom was right, but it was all wrong. Too much was wrong.
"Will you write releases for these other men? You know Asunawa will find a way to accuse them, too. Will you write releases for the children who don't want to help the Seanchan take our lands in the name of a man dead more than 1,000 years?
Several Terrabanners exchanged glances and nodded, and so did other men, not all of them Amadisian.
"What about the men who defended the Fortress of the Light? Will any release get their chains struck off or make the Seanchan stop working them like animals?"
More angry growls. Those prisoners were a sore point to all of the children. Arms folded across his chest, Trom studied him as though seeing him for the first time.
"What would you do, then?"
"Have the children find someone, anyone, who is fighting the Seanchan and ally with them. Make sure that the Children of the Light ride in the last battle, instead of helping the Seanchan hunt Aiel and steal our nations."
"Anyone?"
A Kyriana named Dwarelen said in a high-pitched voice. No one ever made fun of Dwarelen's voice. Though short, he was nearly as wide as he was tall. There was barely an ounce of fat on him, and he could put walnuts between all of his fingers and crack them by clenching his fists.
"That could mean Aes Sedai."
"If you intend to be at Tarmon Gaiden, then you will have to fight alongside Aes Sedai," Galad said quietly.
Young Bornhold grimaced in strong distaste, and he was not the only one. Bjar half-straightened before bending back to his task. But no one voiced dissent. Dwarelen nodded slowly, as if he had never before considered the matter.
"I don't hold with the witches any more than any other man," Bjar said finally, without raising his head from his work.
Blood was seeping through the bandages even as he rapped.
"But the precepts say, to fight the raven, you may make alliance with the serpent until the battle is done."
A ripple of nods ran through the men. The raven meant the shadow, but everyone knew it was also the Seanchan imperial sigil.
"I'll fight beside the witches," a lanky Terrabanner said, "or even these Ashaman we keep hearing about, if they fight the Seanchan. Or at the last battle. And I'll fight any man who says I'm wrong."
He glared as though ready to begin then and there.
"It seems matters will play out as you wish, my lord captain commander," Trom said, making a much deeper bow than he had for Valda. "To a degree, at least. Who can say what the next hour will bring, much less tomorrow?"
Galad surprised himself by laughing. Since yesterday, he had been sure he would never laugh again.
"That's a poor joke, Trom."
"It is how the law is written, and Valda did make his proclamation. Besides, you had the courage to say what many have thought while holding their tongues, myself among them. Yours is a better plan for the children than any I've heard since Pedran Nile died."
"It's still a poor joke."
Whatever the law said, that part had been ignored since the end of the War of the 100 Years.
"We'll see what the children have to say on the matter," Trom replied, grinning widely,
when you asked them to follow us to Tarmon Gaiden to fight alongside the witches.
Men began slapping their shoulders again, harder than they had for his victory. At first it was only a few, then more joined in, until every man, including Trom, was signaling approval. Every man but Kashgar, that was. Making a deep bow, the Saldaean held out the scabbarded heron-mark blade with both hands.
"This is yours now, my lord Captain Commander."
Galad sighed. He hoped this nonsense would fade away before they reached the camp. Returning there was foolish enough without adding in a claim of that sort. Most likely they would be pulled down and thrown in chains, if not beaten to death even without it. But he had to go. It was the right thing to do. Daylight began to grow on this cool spring morning, though the sun had yet to show even a sliver above the horizon, and Rodolai Tiralda raised his gold-banded looking-glass to study the village below the hill where he sat his roan gelding, deep in the heart of Terrabon. He did hate waiting for enough light to see. Careful of a glint off the lens, he held the end of the long tube on his thumb and shaded it with a cupped hand. At this hour, sentries were at their least watchful, relieved that the darkness where an enemy might sneak close was departing. Yet since crossing from Almuth Plain, he had heard tales of Aiel raids inside Terrabon. Were he a sentry with Aiel perhaps about, he would grow extra eyes. Peculiar that the country was not milling like a kicked anthill over those Aiel. Peculiar and perhaps ominous. There were plenty of armed men to be found, Shonshan and Terrabonners sworn to them, and hordes of Shonshan building farms and even villages. But reaching this far had been almost too easy. Today, the easiness ended. Behind him among the trees, horses stamped impatiently. The 100 Damani with him were quiet, except for an occasional creak of saddle leather as a man shifted his seat. But he could feel their tension. He wished he had twice as many. 5 times. In the beginning it had seemed a gesture of good faith that he himself would ride with a force mainly composed of Terrabonners. He was no longer certain that had been the right decision. It was too late for recriminations in any event. Halfway between Elmora and the Amadisian border, Sarana sat in a flat grassy valley among forested hills with at least a mile to the trees in any direction save his, and a small, reed-fringed lake fed by 2 wide streams lay between him and the village. Not a place that could be surprised by daylight. It had been sizable before the Shonshan came, a stopping point for the merchant trains heading east, with over 12 inns and nearly as many streets. Village folk were already getting about their day's tasks, women balancing baskets on their heads as they glided down the village streets, and others starting the fires under laundry kettles behind their houses, men striding along toward their workplaces, sometimes pausing to exchange a few words. A normal morning, with children already running and playing, rolling hoops and tossing bean bags among the throng. The clang of a smithy rose, dim with the distance. The smoke from breakfast fires was fading at the chimneys. As far as he could see, no one in Serana gave a second glance to the 3 pairs of sentries, with bright stripes painted across their breastplates, walking their horses back and forth perhaps 1/4 mile out. The lake, considerably wider than the village, shielded the 4th side effectively. It seemed the sentries were an accepted matter of every day, and so was the Shonshan camp that had swollen Serana to more than 2x its former size. Aitaralda shook his head slightly. He would not have placed the camp cheek by jowl with the village that way. The rooftops of Serana were all tile, red or green or blue, but the buildings themselves were wooden. A fire in the town could spread all too easily into the camp, where canvas store tents the size of large houses far outnumbered the smaller tents where men slept, and great stacks of barrels and casks and crates covered 2x as much ground as all the tents combined. Keeping light-fingered villagers out would be all but impossible. Every town had a few tick birds who picked up anything they thought they could get away with, and even somewhat more honest men might be tempted by the proximity. The location did mean a shorter distance to haul water from the lake, and a shorter distance for soldiers to walk to reach the ale and wine in the village when off duty, but it suggested a commander who kept slack discipline. Slack discipline or not, there was activity in the camp, too. Soldiers' hours made farmers' hours seem restful. Men were checking the animals on the long horse lines, bannermen checking soldiers standing in ranks, hundreds of laborers loading or unloading wagons, grooms harnessing teams. Every day trains of wagons came down the road into this camp from east and west, and others departed. He admired the Seanchan efficiency at making sure their soldiers had what they needed when and where it was needed. Dragons sworn here in Terrabon, most sour-faced men who believed their dream snuffed out by the Seanchan had been willing to tell what they knew if not to ride with him. That camp contained everything from boots to swords, arrows to horseshoes to water flasks, enough to outfit thousands of men from the ground up. They would feel its loss. He lowered the looking glass to brush a buzzing green fly away from his face. Two replaced it almost at once. Terrabon teemed with flies. Did they always come so early here? They would just have begun hatching at home by the time he reached Aradamon again. If he did. No ill thoughts. When he did. Thompson would be displeased otherwise, and it was seldom wise to displease her too far. Most of the men down there were hired workmen, not soldiers, and only 100 or so of those Seanchan. Still, a company of 300 Terrabonners in stripe-painted armor had ridden in at noon the day before, more than doubling their numbers and requiring him to change his plans. Another party of Terrabonners, as large, had entered the camp at sunset, just in time to eat and bed down wherever they could lay their blankets. Candles and lamp oil were luxuries for soldiers. There was one of those leashed women, a Demani in the camp, too. He wished he could have waited until she left. They must have been taking her elsewhere. What use for a Demani at a supply camp? But today was the appointed day, and he could not afford to give the Terrabonners reason to claim he was holding back. Some would snatch at any reason to go their own way. He knew they would not follow him much longer, yet he needed to hold as many as he could for a few days more. Shifting his gaze to the west, he did not bother with the looking-glass. "No," he whispered, as though at his command 200 men with male veils across their faces galloped out of the trees. And immediately halted, cavorting and jockeying for place, brandishing steel-tipped lances while their leader raced up and down before them, gesturing wildly, in an obvious effort to establish some semblance of order. At this distance, Iteralda could not have made out faces even with the glass, but he could imagine the fury on Tournai Lanassier's features at playing out this charade. The stocky dragon-sworn burned to close with Seanchan, any Seanchan. It had been difficult to dissuade him from striking the day they crossed the border. Yesterday he had been visibly overjoyed finally to scrape the hated stripes indicating loyalty to the Seanchan from his breastplate. No matter. So far he was obeying his orders to the letter. As the sentries nearest Lanassier turned their mounts to speed toward the village in the Seanchan camp, Iteralda swung his attention there and raised his looking-glass once more. The sentries would find their warning superfluous. Motion had ceased. Some men were pointing toward the horsemen on the other side of the village, while the rest seemed to be staring, soldiers and workmen alike. The last thing they expected was raiders. Aiel raids or no Aiel raids, the Seanchan considered Terrabon theirs, and safely so. A quick glance at the village showed people standing in the streets, staring toward the strange riders. They had not expected raiders either. He thought the Seanchan were right, an opinion he would not share with any Terrabonner in the foreseeable future. With well-trained men, shock could last only so long, however. In the camp, soldiers began racing toward their horses, many still unsaddled, the grooms had started working as fast as they could. 80-odd Seanchan footmen, archers, formed into ranks and set off running through Serana. At that evidence, that there truly was a threat, people began snatching up the smaller children and heading the older toward the hoped-for safety of the houses. In moments, the streets were empty save for the hurrying archers in their lacquered armor and peculiar helmets. Iteralda turned the glass toward Lanassier and found the man galloping his line of horsemen forward.
"Wait for it," he growled. "Wait for it."
Again it seemed the Terrabonner heard his command, finally raising a hand to halt his men. At least they were still a half mile or more from the village. The hot-headed fool was supposed to be near a mile away, on the edge of the trees and still in seeming disorder and easily swept away,
but half would have to suffice. He suppressed the urge to finger the ruby in his left ear. The battle had begun now, and in battle you had to make those following you believe that you were utterly cool, completely unaffected, not wanting to knock down a putative ally. Emotion seemed to leak from a commander into his men, and angry men behaved stupidly, getting themselves killed and losing battles. Touching the half-moon-shaped beauty patch on his cheek, a man should look his best on a day like today. He took slow, measured breaths, until certain that he was as cool inside as his outward display, then returned his attention to the camp. Most of the Terrabonners there were mounted now, but they waited for 20 or so Shonchen, led by a tall fellow with a single thin plume on his curious helmet, to gallop into the village before falling in behind, yesterday's latecomers trailing at the rear. Iteralda studied the figure leading the column, viewing him through the gaps between houses. A single plume would mark a lieutenant or maybe an under-lieutenant, which might mean a beardless boy on his first command or a grizzled veteran who could take your head if you made one mistake. Strangely, the Damani, marked by the shining silvery leash that connected her to a woman on another horse, galloped her animal as hard as anyone. Everything he had heard said Damani were prisoners, yet she appeared as eager as the other woman, the Suldam. Perhaps... Abruptly his breath caught in his throat, and all thought of Damani fled. There were people in the street, seven or eight men and women walking in a cluster and right ahead of the racing column that they seemed not to hear thundering up behind them. There was no time for the Shonchan to stop if they wanted to, and good reason not to try with an enemy ahead, but it looked as though the tall fellow's hand never twitched on his reins as he and the rest rode the people down. A veteran, then. Murmuring a prayer for the dead, Iteralda lowered the glass. What came next was best seen without it. 200 paces beyond the village, the officer started forming his command, where the archers had already stopped, and were waiting with nocked arrows. Waving directions to the Terrabonners behind, he turned to peer at Lanassier through a looking glass. Sunlight glinted off the tube's banding. The sun was rising now. The Terrabonners began dividing smoothly, lance heads glittering and all slanted at the same angle, disciplined men falling into ordered ranks to either side of the archers. The officer leaned over to converse with the Suldam. If he turned her and the Damani loose now, this could still turn into a disaster. Of course it could if he did not, too. The last of the Terrabonners, those who had arrived late, began stretching out in a line 50 paces behind the others, driving their lances point down into the ground and pulling their horse bows from the cases fastened behind their saddles. Lanassier, cursed the man, was galloping his men forward. Turning his head for a moment, Iteralda spoke loudly enough for the men behind him to hear. "Be ready." Saddle leather creaked as men gathered their reins. Then he murmured another prayer for the dead and whispered, "Now." As one man, the 300 Terrabonners in the long line, his Terrabonners, raised their bows and loosed. He did not need the looking glass to see the Suldam and Damani and the officer suddenly sprout arrows. They were all but swept from their saddles by near a dozen, striking each of them at once. Ordering that had given him a pang, but the women were the most dangerous people on that field. The rest of that volley cut down most of the archers and cleared saddles, and even as men struck the ground a second volley lanced out, knocking down the last archers and emptying more saddles. Caught by surprise, the Shonchen loyal Terrabonners tried to fight. Among those still mounted, some wheeled about and lowered their lances to charge their attackers. Others, perhaps seized by the irrationality that they could take men in battle, dropped their lances and tried to uncase their own horse bows. But a third volley lashed them, pile-headed arrows driving through breastplates at that range, and suddenly the survivors seemed to realize that they were survivors. Most of their fellows lay still on the ground or struggled to stand, though pierced by two or three shafts. Those still mounted were now outnumbered by their opponents. A few men reined their horses around, and in a flash the lot of them were running south, pursued by one final rain of bowshot that toppled more. "Hold," Iteralda murmured. "Hold where you are." A handful of the mounted archers fired again, but the rest wisely refrained. They could kill a few more before the enemy was beyond range, but this group was beaten, and before long they would be counting every arrow.
Best of all, none of them went racing in pursuit. The same could not be said of Lanassier. Cloaks streaming, he and his 200 raced after the fleeing men. Iteralda imagined he could hear them yelping, hunters on the trail of running prey.
"I think we've seen the last of Lanassier, my lord," Jollum said, reining his grey up beside Iteralda, who shrugged slightly.
"Perhaps, my young friend, he may come to his senses. In any case, I never thought the Terrabonners would return to Arad Daman with us. Did you?"
"No, my lord," the taller man replied. "But I thought his honor would hold through the first fight."
Iteralda lifted his glass to look at Lanassier, still galloping hard. The man was gone, and unlikely to come to his senses, he did not possess. A third of his force gone as surely as if that Damani had killed them. He had counted on a few more days. He would need to change plans again, perhaps change his next target. Dismissing Lanassier from his thoughts, he swung the glass to glance at where those people had been ridden down and grunted in surprise. There were no trampled bodies. Friends and neighbors must have come out to carry them away, though with a battle on the edge of the village, that seemed about as likely as them getting up and walking away after the horses passed.
"It's time to go burn all those lovely Shonchan stores," he said.
Shoving the looking-glass into the leather case tied to his saddle, he had donned his helmet and heeled steady down the hill, followed by Jollum and the others in a column of twos. Ruts from farm wagons and broken-down banks indicated a ford in the eastern stream.
"And, Jollum, tell a few men to warn the villagers to start moving what they want to save. Tell them to begin with the houses nearest the camp.
Where fire could spread one way, it could the other, too, and likely would." In truth, he had already set the important blaze, breathed on the first embers, at least. If the light shone on him, if no one had been overcome by eagerness or given into despair at the hold the Shonchan had on Terrabon, if no one had fallen afoul of the mishaps that could ruin the best-laid plan, then all across Terrabon, above 20,000 men had struck blows like this, or would before the day was out. And tomorrow they would do it again. Now all he had to do was raid his way back across better than 400 miles of Terrabon, shedding Terrabonner dragon sworn and gathering in his own men, then recross Almuth Plain. If the light shone on him, that blaze would singe the Shonchan enough to bring them chasing after him full of fury. A great deal of fury, he hoped. That way they would run headlong into the trap he had laid before they ever knew it was there. If they failed to follow, then at least he had rid his homeland of the Terrabonners and bound the Damani dragon sworn to fight for the king instead of against him. And if they saw the trap? Riding down the hillside, Iteralda smiled. If they saw the trap, then he had another plan already laid, and another behind that. He always looked ahead and always planned for every eventuality he could imagine, short of the dragon reborn himself suddenly appearing in front of him. He thought the plans he had would suffice for the moment.
The High Lady Suroth Sabel Meldareth lay awake on her bed, staring up at the ceiling. The moon was down, and the triple-arched windows that overlooked a palace garden were dark, but her eyes had adjusted so that she could make out at least the outlines of the ornate, painted plasterwork. Dawn was no more than an hour or two off, yet she had not slept. She had lain awake most nights since Tuon vanished, sleeping only when exhaustion closed her eyes, however hard she tried to keep them open. Sleep brought nightmares she wished she could forget. Ebudar was never truly cold, but the night held a little coolness, enough to keep her awake, lying beneath only a thin silk sheet. The question that tainted her dreams was simple and stark. Was Tuon alive or dead? The escape of the Atha Anmir Damani and Queen Tylan's murder spoke in favor of her death. Three events of that magnitude happening on one night by chance was pressing coincidence too far, and the first two were horrifying enough in themselves to indicate the worst for Tuon. Someone was trying to sow fear among the Hriagel, those who come home, perhaps to disrupt the entire return. How better to achieve that than to assassinate Tuon? Worse, it had to be one of their own.
Because she had landed under the veil, no local knew who Tuon was. Tylin had surely been killed with the One Power, by Isuldam and her Damani. Suroth had leaped at the suggestion that Aes Sedai were to blame, yet eventually someone who mattered would question how one of those women could enter a palace full of Damani, in a city full of Damani, and escape detection. At least one Suldam had been necessary to uncollar the sea folk Damani, and two of her own Suldam had disappeared at almost the same time. In any case, they had been noticed as missing 2 days later, and no one had seen them since the night Tuon vanished. She did not believe they were involved, though they had been in the kennels. For one thing, she could not imagine Rena or Sita uncollaring a Damani. They certainly had reasons enough to sneak away and seek employment far off, with someone ignorant of their filthy secret. Someone like this Aginan Tamaroth, who had stolen a pair of a Damani. Strange that, for one newly raised to the blood. Strange, but unimportant. She could see no way to tie it to the rest. Likely the woman had found the stresses and complexities of nobility too much for a simple sailor. Well, she would be found and arrested eventually. The important fact, the potentially deadly fact, was that Rena and Sita were gone, and no one could say exactly when they had left. If the wrong person noted their departure so close to the critical time and made the wrong calculation, she pressed the heels of her hands against her eyes and exhaled softly, very near to a groan. Even should she escape suspicion of murdering Tuon, if the woman was dead, then she herself would be required to apologize to the Empress, might she live forever. For the death of the acknowledged heir to the Crystal Throne, her apology would be protracted, and as painful as it was humiliating. It might end with her execution, or much worse, with being sent to the block as property. Not that it would actually come to that, though in her nightmares it often did. Her hand slid beneath the pillows to touch the unsheathed dagger there. The blade was little longer than her hand, yet more than sharp enough to open her veins, preferably in a warm bath. If time came for an apology, she would not live to reach Shandar. The dishonor to her name might even be lessened a little if enough people believed the act was itself an apology. She would leave a letter explaining it, so that might help. Still, there was a chance Tuon remained alive, and Suroth clung to it. Killing her and spiriting the body away might be a deep move ordered from Shanchan by one of her surviving sisters who coveted the throne. Yet Tuon had arranged her own disappearance more than once. In support of the notion, Tuon's Dersuldam had taken all of her Suldam and Damani into the country for exercise 9 days ago, and they had not been seen since. Exercising Damani did not require 9 days, and just today, no, yesterday now by a good few hours, Suroth had learned that the captain of Tuon's bodyguard also had left the city 9 days ago with a sizable contingent of his men, and not returned. That was too much for coincidence, and very nearly proof. Near enough for hope, at least. Each of those previous disappearances, however, had been part of Tuon's campaign to win the approval of the Empress, might she live forever, and be named heir. Each time some competitor among her sisters had been forced or emboldened to acts that lowered her when Tuon reappeared. What need had she of such stratagems now, here? Rack her brains how she would, Suroth could not find a worthy target outside Shanshan. She had considered the possibility that she herself was the mark, but only briefly, and only because she could think of no one else. Tuon could have stripped her of her position in the return with 3 words. All she needed to do was remove the veil. Here, the daughter of the 9 moons, in command of the return, spoke with the voice of the Empire. Bare suspicion that Suroth was Atha An Shadar, what those this side of the Arath Ocean called a dark friend, might have been enough for Tuon to have handed her over to the Seekers for questioning. No, Tuon was aiming at someone else, or something else, if she did still live. But she had to. Suroth did not want to die. She fingered the blade. Who or what else did not matter, except as a clue to where Tuon might be, but that was very important, immensely so. Already, despite the announcement of an extended inspection trip, whispers floated among the blood that she was dead. The longer she remained missing, the more those whispers would grow, and with them the pressure for Suroth to return to Shandar and make that apology. She could only resist so long before she would be adjudged Saimosief so deeply that only her own servants and property would obey her. Her eyes would be ground into the dirt. Low blood as well as high, perhaps even commoners would refuse to speak to her. Soon after that she would find herself on a ship, whatever her wishes. Without doubt, Tuon would be displeased at being found, yet it seemed unlikely her displeasure would extend so far as Suroth being dishonored and forced to slit her wrists. Therefore, Tuon must be found. Every seeker in Altara was searching for her, those Suroth knew of, at least. Tuon's own seekers were not among the known, yet they must be hunting twice as hard as any others, unless they had been taken into her confidence. But in 17 days, all that had been uncovered was that ridiculous story of Tuon extorting jewelry from goldsmiths, and that was known to every common soldier. Perhaps... The arched door to the anteroom began to open slowly, and Suroth snapped her right eye shut to protect her night vision against the light of the outer room. As soon as the gap was wide enough, a pale-haired woman in the diaphanous robes of a Dako veil slipped into the bedchamber and softly closed the door behind her, plunging the room into pitch blackness. Until Suroth opened her eye again and made out a shadowy form creeping toward her bed. And another shadow, huge, suddenly looming in a corner of the room as Almandaragal rose noiselessly to his feet. The Lopar could cross the room and snap the fool woman's neck in a heartbeat, but Suroth still gripped the hilt of her dagger. It was wise to have a second line of defense, even when the first seemed impregnable. A pace short of the bed, the Dako veil stopped. Her anxious breathing sounded loud in the silence.
"Working up your courage, Leandrin," Suroth said harshly.
That honey-colored hair, worked in thin braids, had been enough to name her. With a squeak, the Dako veil dropped to her knees and bent to press her face to the carpet. She had learned that much, at least.
"I would not harm you, High Lady," she lied. "You know I would not."
Her voice was rushed, in a breathy panic. Learning when to speak and when not seemed as far beyond her as learning how to speak with proper respect.
"We are both bound to serve the Great Lord, High Lady. Have I not proven I can be useful? I removed Alwyn for you, yes? You said you wished her dead, High Lady, and I removed her."
Suroth grimaced and sat up in the dark, the sheet sliding down to her lap. It was so easy to forget Dako veil were there, even this Dako veil, and then you let slip things you should not have. Alwyn had not been dangerous, merely a nuisance, awkward in her place as Suroth's voice. She had achieved all she had ever wanted in reaching that, and the likelihood of her risking it by so much as the smallest betrayal had been tiny. True, had she broken her neck falling down a flight of stairs, Suroth would have felt some small relief from an irritant, but poison that left the woman with bulging eyes and a blue face was another matter. Even with the search for Tuon, that had brought the seeker's eyes to Suroth's household. She had been forced to insist on it for the murder of her voice. That there were listeners in her household she accepted. Every household had its share of listeners. Seekers did more than listen, though, and they might uncover what must remain hidden. Masking her anger required surprising effort, and her tone was colder than she wanted.
"I hope you did not wake me merely to plead again, Leandrin."
"No, no!"
The fool raised her head and actually looked straight at her.
"An officer came from General Galgan, High Lady. He is waiting to take you to the general."
Suroth's head throbbed with irritation. The woman delayed delivering a message from Galgan and looked her in the eyes? In the dark, to be sure, yet an urge swept over her to strangle Leandrin with her bare hands. A second death hard on the heels of the first would intensify the seeker's interest in her household if they learned of it, but Elbar could dispose of the body easily. He was clever in such tasks. Except... she enjoyed owning the former Aes Sedai who once had been so haughty with her. Making her a perfect Dako veil in every way would be a great pleasure. It was time to have the woman collared, however. Already, irritating rumors buzzed of an uncollared Marath Damani among her servants.
It would be a 12-day wonder when the Suldam discovered she was shielded in some way so she could not channel. Yet that would help answer the question of why she had not been leashed before. Elbar would need to find some Atha'an Shadar among the Suldam, though. That was never an easy task. Relatively few Suldam returned to the Great Lord, oddly, and she no longer really trusted any Suldam. But perhaps Atha'an Shadar could be trusted more than the rest.
"Light two lamps, then bring me a robe and slippers," she said, swinging her legs over the side of the bed.
Leandrin scrambled to the table that held the lidded sand bowl on its gilded tripod and hissed when she found it with a careless hand, but she quickly used the tongs to lift out a hot coal, puffed it to a glow, and lit two of the silvered lamps, adjusting the wicks so the flames held steady and did not smoke. Her tongue might suggest that she felt herself Surath's equal rather than a possession, yet the strap had taught her to obey commands with alacrity. Turning with one of the lamps in her hand, she gave a start and a choked cry at the sight of Almandaragal looming in the corner, his dark, ridge-ringed eyes focused on her. You would think she had never seen him before. Yet he was a fearsome sight, 10 feet tall and near 2,000 pounds, his hairless skin like reddish-brown leather, flexing his six-toed forepaws so his claws extended and retracted. "Be at ease," Surath told the Lopar, a familiar command, but he stretched his mouth wide, showing sharp teeth, before settling back to the floor and resting his huge round head on his paws like a hound. He did not close his eyes again, either. Lopar were quite intelligent, and plainly he trusted Leandrin no more than she did. Despite fearful glances at Almandaragal, the Duck-o-Vale was quick enough to fetch blue velvet slippers and a white silk robe intricately embroidered in green, red, and blue from the tall, carved wardrobe, and she held the robe for Surath to thrust her arms into the sleeves. But Surath had to tie the long sash herself, and to thrust out a foot, before Leandrin remembered to kneel and fit the slippers on. Her eyes, but the woman was incompetent. By the dim light, Surath examined herself in the gilded stand mirror against the wall. Her eyes were hollow and shadowed with weariness. The tail of her crest hung down her back in a loose braid for sleeping, and doubtless her scalp required a razor. Very well. Galgan's messenger would think her grief-stricken over Tuon, and that was true enough. Before learning the general's message, though, she had one small matter to take care of.
"Run to Rosala and beg her to beat you soundly, Leandrin," she said.
The Duck-o-Vale's tight little mouth dropped open and her eyes widened in shock. "But why?" she whined. "Me, I have done nothing." Surath busied her hands with knotting the sash tighter to keep from striking the woman. Her eyes would be lowered for a month if it was learned that she had struck a Duck-o-Vale herself. She certainly owed no explanations to property, yet once Leandrin did become completely trained, she would miss these opportunities to grind the woman's face in how far she had fallen.
"Because you delayed telling me of the general's messenger. Because you still call yourself I rather than Leandrin. Because you meet my eyes."
She could not help hissing that. Leandrin had huddled in on herself with every word, and now she directed her eyes to the floor as if that would mitigate her offense.
"Because you questioned my orders instead of obeying. And last but most importantly to you, because I wish you beaten. Now run and tell Rosala each of these reasons so she will beat you well."
"Leandrin hears and obeys, High Lady," the Duck-o-Vale whimpered, at last getting something right, and flung herself at the door so fast that she lost one of her white slippers. Too terrified to turn back for it, or perhaps even to notice, and well for her that she was, she clawed the door open and ran. Sending property for discipline should not bring a sense of satisfaction, but it did. Oh, yes, it did. Surath took a moment to control her breathing. To appear to be grieving was one thing, to appear to be agitated, quite another. She was filled with annoyance at Leandrin, jolting memories of her nightmares, fears for Tuon's fate and even more so her own, but not until the face in the mirror displayed utter calm did she follow the Duck-o-Vale.
The anteroom to her bedchamber was decorated in the garish Ebudari fashion, a cloud-painted blue ceiling, yellow walls, and green and yellow floor tiles, even replacing the furnishings with her own tall screens. All save two, painted by the finest artists with birds or flowers, did little to relieve the gaudiness. She growled faintly in her throat at sight of the outer door, apparently left open by Leandrin in her flight. But she dismissed the Dako veil from her mind for the moment and concentrated on the man who stood there examining the screen that held the image of a Kori, a huge spotted cat from the Centaur. Lanky and graying in armor striped blue and yellow, he pivoted smoothly at the soft sound of her footsteps and went to one knee, though he was a commoner. The helmet beneath his arm bore three slender blue plumes, so the message must be important. Of course it must be important to disturb her at this hour. She would give him dispensation. This once.
Banner General Mihail Najira, High Lady. Captain General Galgun's compliments, and he has received communications from Tarabon.
Suroth's eyebrows climbed in spite of herself. Tarabon? Tarabon was as secure as Shondar. Automatically her fingers twitched, but she had not yet found a replacement for Alwyn. She must speak to the man herself. Irritation over that hardened her voice, and she made no effort to soften it. Kneeling instead of prostrate.
What communications? If I have been wakened for news of Aiel, I will not be pleased, Banner General.
Her tone failed to intimidate the man. He even raised his eyes almost to meet hers.
Not Aiel, High Lady, he said calmly. Captain General Galgun wishes to tell you himself so you can hear every detail correctly.
Suroth's breath caught for an instant. Whether Najira was just reluctant to tell her the contents of these communications or had been ordered not to, this sounded ill.
"Lead on," she commanded, then swept out of the room without waiting for him, ignoring as best she could the pair of Death Watch guards standing like statues in the hallway to either side of the door.
The honor of being guarded by those men in red and green armor made her skin crawl. Since Tuan's disappearance, she tried not to see them at all. The corridor, lined with gilded stand lamps whose flames flickered in errant drafts that stirred tapestries of ships and the sea, was empty except for a few liveried palace servants, scurrying on early tasks, who thought deep bows and curtsies sufficient. And they always looked right at her. Perhaps a word with Beslan? No, the new king was her equal now, in law at any rate, and she doubted that he would make his servants behave properly. She stared straight ahead as she walked. That way she did not have to see the servants' insults. Najira caught up to her quickly, his boots ringing on the two bright blue floor tiles, and fell in at her side. In truth, she needed no guide. She knew where Galgun must be. The room had begun as a chamber for dancing, a square 30 paces on a side, its ceiling painted with fanciful fish and birds frolicking in often confusing fashion among clouds and waves. Only the ceiling remained to recall the room's beginnings. Now mirrored stand lamps and shelves full of filed reports in leather folders lined the pale red walls. Brown-coated clerks scurried along the aisles between the long map-strewn tables that covered the green-tiled dancing floor. A young officer, an under-lieutenant with no plume on her red and yellow helmet, raced past Suroth without so much as a move to prostrate herself. Clerks merely squeezed themselves out of her path. Galgun gave his people too much leeway. He claimed that what he called excessive ceremony at the wrong time hindered efficiency. She called it effrontery. Lunal Galgun, a tall man in a red robe richly worked with bright-feathered birds, the hair of his crest snow-white and its tail plaited in a tight but untidy queue that hung to his shoulders, stood at a table near the center of the room with a knot of other high-ranking officers, some in breastplates, others in robes and nearly as disheveled as she. It seemed she was not the first to whom he had sent a messenger. She struggled to keep anger from her face. Galgun had come with Tuon and the Return, and thus she knew little of him beyond that his ancestors had been among the first to throw their support to Luthair Peyondrag, and that he owned a high reputation as a soldier and a general.
Well, reputation and truth were sometimes the same. She disliked him entirely for himself. He turned at her approach and formally laid his hands on her shoulders, kissing her on either cheek, so she was forced to return the greeting while trying not to wrinkle her nose at the strong, musky scent he favored. Galgan's face was as smooth as his creases would allow, but she thought she detected a hint of worry in his blue eyes. A number of the men and women behind him, mainly low blood and commoners, wore open frowns.